The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Olivia, if you'd like to come in, you can. If you'd like to stay out there, you can stay out there too. So good morning and Happy New Year to everybody. So this morning I wanted to talk about questioning, just like the act of questioning. And for me, when I think about this, when we have a question about something, it means that we're engaged with it, we're thinking about it, and not just passively letting it wash over us, or you know, we're just like just consuming it and not really engaging with it. It's kind of a way of rolling up our sleeves and maybe wrestling with a topic is when we have questions. But even the act of having questions makes the assumption that there's a rationale, that there's a logic, that there's an answer. Right? In some traditions, you're not encouraged to question so much. It's just belief. There isn't an emphasis on understanding or an emphasis on, of course, it's rational or logic. Rather, it's just belief. But that's not the case in this tradition here. Also, having questions implies a willingness to be open to new ideas, rather than thinking like, okay, I got that. I know that. Which, you know, kind of supports boredom and aversion and, you know, wishing that you were doing something else or somewhere else. If we're a little bit engaged, if we have questions or are thinking about questions, then it's a way for us to stay open to, even though we may be familiar with the topic in general, maybe there's something new, maybe there's a nugget for us to hear, to learn about that can really be impactful and helpful. Also, having questions includes having a willingness to be surprised. So instead of thinking that we know it all, thinking like, there may be something here. Randy mentioned that I've done a lot of retreat practice. And when I go on retreats, I make little posters that I put on the wall of my bedroom to kind of support me, right, in this endeavor. And one little poster that I make says, "Be willing to be surprised." This has turned out to be enormously helpful, because what I discovered I was doing is sometimes I like wake up and I'd be like really tired. I didn't feel like going to the meditation hall. I'd been there for days. I was all there all day yesterday. I know exactly what's going to happen when I show up and I'm tired. Like, I have this idea that I know what's going to happen, and I don't want to go because, like, oh, yeah, yesterday it was like this. But this be willing to be surprised, it's like, yeah, well, actually, I don't know. Maybe today will be a little bit different. And in fact, actually, if I do accurately remember, nothing is exactly the same, right, every time we do something. Right, we wouldn't keep on coming to IMC on a Tuesday morning if it was always exactly the same, right? So all these things that we do repeatedly, because even though they may be very similar and have so many elements that are consistent, part of this practice is also to show us how things do change. And so this willingness to be surprised is also a way to notice what is different, how have things changed, which is an integral part of our practice. Perhaps many of you are familiar with this very famous book by Shinryu Suzuki, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, right? Just pointing to the importance of the willingness to not to be a beginner, to feel like freshly examine things. And there's a story that's often told. I know I've heard it in a number of different contexts. That goes something like this. Somebody like a professor shows up, a professor of Buddha studies, let's say, and wants to learn about Buddhism. But this person thinks that he or she already knows everything, having read all the scriptures and studied all the texts or something, and thinks, okay, well, now what I need to do is go interview the director of a monastery or something like this. So this professor goes, talks to a Zen master. The Zen master greets the professor, invites them in, offers them a cup of tea. And the professor is holding the cup of tea. The Zen master is pouring. Of course, the cup fills up. The Zen master continues to pour. The tea is spilling all on the ground, making a mess. And the professor says, "What are you doing? Why are you keep pouring the tea? The cup is full." The Zen master doesn't say anything initially, right? And then the professor, in some versions of the story, then the professor realizes, oh, this is a teaching. He's making a point that when the cup is already full, there isn't room for anything more. And the Zen master, that was his way of pointing out to the professor that the professor already felt like he had all the answers and really wasn't going to learn. And, you know, was it just going to acquire more knowledge? He felt like, the professor already felt like he had it all figured out. I think this is actually very powerful, to this idea of like having questioning, well, what else is there? What do I not know about this? Sure, I know all about this, but are there gaps in my knowledge? Are there things that are fuzzy, things that aren't clear? How do I know when I really understand something? Or do I even need to really understand? Can I still engage with it with a freshness, with some inquiry, with a sense of inquiry, rather than kind of this dismissive, okay, been there, done that, I know this. And then if we look back at the scriptures, the suttas, we see that the Buddha really encouraged questions, as well as he used questions in his and the way that he taught. That was part of his teaching style. His pedagogical style was to use questions. But at this time in ancient India, it was kind of a form of entertainment, you can imagine, right? Thousands of years ago, what kind of entertainment they had was debate. This was commonly done amongst different philosophers. And so there would be a lot of people that would come to the Buddha and have a debate with him. They would be from other traditions. And of course, right, these are preserved in the Buddha scriptures. So of course, the Buddha always wins, right, in the stories that we have. We don't know what actually happened in ancient India. We just have what's preserved in these stories. But it does show that the Buddha often, readily engaging with questions and asking questions back for the interlocutors, the people who are asking the questions. But it wasn't only practitioners of other traditions trying to show who's the smartest or who has the best dharma, who has the best teaching. It was also the followers of the Buddha, the monks and the nuns. Of course, they would ask him questions too. And just the fact that he encouraged asking questions and that he would readily answer questions, points to the part of the how he taught, this idea of it's good to get engaged and to, as I said earlier, kind of like roll up your sleeves, and to have this idea that to recognize one of his core teachings, of course, is that there is suffering and the end of suffering, and to recognize, oh, this is suffering, this is uncomfortable, this is stressful, this is not what I wish for. And then to have a question, is there an end to this? Does it have to be this way? What is the cause of this? So just the Buddha's willingness to answer questions and his encouragement to ask questions is part of his way that he was demonstrating, here's a way to engage with your life, here's a way to engage with your practice. And he wanted them to recognize when something is wrong, when they're suffering, but also by the asking questions and finding answers, or not finding answers and still being okay with having questions that don't have answers gives us a type of confidence. Just that engaging and thinking about it and sometimes finding answers and not finding answers, but somehow being okay with, okay, I don't quite get this yet, but that's all right. Maybe I'm not answering the right question. Maybe I'm not asking the right person. Maybe the question should be a little bit different. But to just engage in that way can kind of instill some confidence that it's okay to have inquiry, to not be sure, to engage. I keep on using this word, but that's how I feel about to kind of engage with the teachings and with the practice. So here's a quote from the suttas where the Buddha's describing he's describing a group of monastics and how they use questions. Having learned the teachings, they interrogate each other about them and examine the teachings thoroughly, asking, how is this? What is the meaning of this? They disclose what is obscure. They elucidate what is unclear and dispel their perplexity about numerous perplexing points. This is an assembly trained in interrogation. And then he went on to contrast it with an assembly, meaning a group of practitioners. Contrast it with those who practiced vain talk, things that didn't really lead to suffering or the end of suffering or didn't lead to greater understanding of ourselves or of the practice. And there are a number of suttas where the stories are of more senior monks teaching the junior monks asking questions of the senior monks. So we see that this was definitely an integral part of the community life in the Buddha's time as well as currently, right, in the monasteries. But for me, one of the big indicators about how important questions are is the death scene of the Buddha. Many of us may be familiar, or maybe not, of what the Buddha's last words were. It gets translated in a number of different ways, but it's often all conditioned things are impermanent. Knowing this well, knowing this deeply causes great happiness. I think I'm misquoting that. I don't have this here. But what often so this is like, because it's the last thing that he said, and then he died right after this. So often there's whole Dharma talks about this, there's chants about this. But what often we don't talk about is what happened right before that, he says, he utters his last teaching. Which I feel really touched by. The story is that the Buddha, he was very sick and had been walking the entire day. He knew he was about to die. He had announced that he was about to die. He was lying down on what would be his deathbed. And because he had known that he was going to die, thousands of people are there to pay their respects. He addresses the monastics and he says, if even a single monk or none. I added that. Technically it says monk. That's a whole other talk about monks and nuns. But if even a single monk has any doubt or uncertainty concerning the Buddha, the Dharma, or the Sangha, the path, or the practice, ask. So he's minutes away from dying. And he says, does anybody have any questions? I feel touched by this for a number of reasons. It starts with saying, if even a single practitioner, a single monk, a single nun has any doubt, he's opening it up to anybody. Does anybody have any questions? It's not just, his attendant and maybe the most senior monks. He was concerned about suffering and the end of suffering, not about who's the most senior person. So he would address wherever suffering he's found it, in whomever he found it. And then he, as I said, he knew that he was going to die. So it's also clear that he wanted there to be clarity. He wanted to make sure that was what he had dedicated his life to teaching others, that there wasn't any loose ends still undone, that there weren't some people who didn't understand. So again, he said, if even a single monk has any doubt or uncertainty concerning the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the path, or the practice, ask. So he's asking them, are there any questions? But he's not saying, is there questions about anything? Why is the sky blue? How do I get my iPhone to sync to my computer? Right? You know, he's listening to these five topics, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, path, and practice. For him, that's what's important, for us to have clarity about these things, for us to have clarity about what does it mean to take refuge? Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. What is the path? How do we know when we're on the path? How do we know when we're off the path? What is the practice? How do we? How does the practice unfold? How do we practice in community? How do we have a meditation practice? These types of things. So that's part of his teaching style as well, is when he had questions, they weren't just completely open-ended. You can ask me anything you want. It's part of his, like, pay attention to these things. If you want to have more freedom, if you want to have an end of suffering, see if you have clarity about these things, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, path, and practice. Also, I could say that these aren't metaphysical questions. What is the meaning of life? What happens after we die? These aren't the questions he was saying that you should concern ourselves with. It's the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the path, and the practice. It's more about experiential. What can we do? What can we know? Rather than philosophy. Even though Buddhism is often talked about a philosophy and a way of life, he wasn't concerned with, you know, the big philosophical questions that don't really have answers. He was concerned with what can we really know? What can we roll up our sleeves, get engaged, and find answers to? So earlier, just a few months earlier, before he dies, there's a story that Mara, who is a character in the early scriptures, who's described in a number of different ways. The contemporary, you know, here in the West, we often think of Mara as somebody, as the personification of those things that prevent us from getting awakened. But he also has a character. So he shows up and has conversations with the Buddha, and the Buddha has conversations with him, so... So in some traditions, they would say he was an actual entity. In some traditions, they'd say it's just a personification of something. So right before this death scene, Mara comes to the Buddha and reports back to the Buddha saying something that the Buddha had said. So this is Mara now speaking to the Buddha. These are the words spoken by you, the Blessed One. Evil one. So that's how this translator is calling Mara, the evil one. I shall not enter final nibbana, I shall not die, until I have monk disciples, nun disciples, men lay followers, women lay followers who are, I'm not inserting this, this is actually in there. That's the Buddha's concerned about men and women, whether they're ordained or not. Kind of covers just, you know, a lot of the humans on this planet. I shall not die until I have monk disciples, nun disciples, men lay followers, women lay followers who are accomplished, trained, skilled, learned, bearers of the Dharma, trained in accordance with the Dharma, correctly trained and walk in the path of the Dharma. So not only do they know the Dharma, but they will pass on what they have gained from their teacher, teach it, declare it, establish it, expound it, analyze it, make it clear, until they shall be able to refute false teachings and teach the Dharma in all its wonder. So the Buddha had made a had told Mara, the evil one, I'm not going to die until I have the four assemblies that really know my teachings. And not only do they know the teachings, but they themselves can teach. This was a commitment that he made. So then he goes on to tell Mara, I'm going to die soon. Don't worry. This is kind of Mara's role. He's displeased that all these people are getting awakened under the Buddha. So I had said that the Buddha had said, if even a single monk has any doubt, according to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, path and practice, and then how did they respond? Silence. He asks a second time, repeating it. Silence. He says, do not afterwards feel remorse, thinking, the teacher was here before us and we failed to ask him when we were in his presence. So the Buddha has compassion. He doesn't want them to feel remorse in the future. And in my interpretation, he's also saying, look, I really am going to die. Most humans, we don't know the moment we're going to die. Apparently the Buddha did. And so he was saying, this is your last chance. Partly we can wonder, or we can imagine, that part of the reason why he made this emphasis on whether they had questions or not about the Dharma is not only because he had made this promise to Mara that he wasn't going to die until he had the four assemblies had knew the Dharma. But as we all know, the Buddha didn't leave a successor. He didn't point somebody and said, okay, you're the next person that's going to lead the community, that's going to make new rules if they're needed, that's going to ordain people if needed. Rich, there wasn't a successor. They even asked him, are you going to leave a successor? Part of his response was this. Dwell with yourself as an island, with yourself as refuge, with no other refuge. Dwell with the Dharma as an island, with the Dharma as refuge, with no other refuge. So he's pointing towards, you can rely on your direct experience, you can rely on your practice, you can rely on the Dharma, on the teachings. There doesn't have to be a living Buddha in order for this tradition to continue. There doesn't have to be a living Buddha in order for you to practice. So the Buddha asked a third time, does anybody have any questions? It was the tradition in ancient India, if anybody asked a question three times, then you had to answer it. So this is pretty unusual to ask a question three times and then for the monastic community to still remain silent. So then he goes on and he says, perhaps you do not ask out of respect for the teacher. Then let one companion tell it to another. I'm not entirely sure what this means, tell it, what one companion tell it to another. I have two ideas about this. One is, if you don't want to ask it out of respect for the teacher, then you can ask it of somebody else, another monastic. But I looked at the Pali here. It's actually not ask another, it's tell another. So I wondered if it wasn't, if you don't want to do it, ask the Buddha something, but you have a question, tell your friend the question, and your friend can ask the Buddha. So either way, they still remained silent. Here we are. And then, here's the quote from, then he dies very soon after. And he says, I exhort you, all formations are of the nature to decay. Strive on heedfully. And then he died. So I had misquoted it earlier. There's a number of different translations. We can stick with this one. For me personally, I love this story about how the Buddha, he really encouraged questions, not just blind faith, not just, because I said so and I know better than you do kind of thinking. It's like, is there anything that's unclear? Do you have doubt about anything? So this is about questions about the teachings, about the practice, about the path. But also, as I alluded to earlier, questioning is part of the path, is part of how we practice also. I can give a few examples. Many of you may be familiar about the five hindrances. These are qualities of mind, states of mind that, not surprisingly, hinder. They get in the way of our meditation practice, of our spiritual life, our spiritual practice. They get in the way of being the best version of ourselves. These five hindrances. The first one is sensual desire. The second one is ill will. Third one is restlessness and worry. The fourth is sloth and torpor. I may have three and four switched, I'm not sure. And the fifth one is doubt. Doubt as a hindrance. This is recognition that, of course, you're going to have doubt, because there's a whole body of teachings about what to do when you have doubt. Of course, you're going to be wondering, do I understand this right? Is this teacher, does he or she really know what she's talking about? Can I do this? Is this the right practice for me? When they talk about doubt, can have the biggest effect on us, partly because it's so difficult to see. Instead, it just feels like a natural, wise thought, like, I don't know, that seems weird. I don't get it. I'm not going to do it. And it just seems like a natural thing. We don't question it. Or, I don't know, maybe everybody else can sit still and meditate for, have more than 10 breaths in a row, but I can't, and I don't know, I'm not going to do this. Right? This is doubt. I had this just recently on a retreat. I was reporting what was happening with my practice to the teacher. For those of you who have been on retreat, you know that every few days you have a one-on-one discussion with a teacher about how things are going. And I was reporting what was going on in my mind and things like this. And he said to me, oh, that's just doubt. And I thought, oh, that's right. I don't have to It doesn't have to be a big, giant problem. Yes, I have these thoughts, these concerns. I can't do it. I'm not sure about these teachings. Are the teachers saying the right thing? Are they giving us the right direction? It's true. I had all those thoughts. That's definitely an experience I had. But it doesn't mean that it's an accurate representation, that it's real in the sense of, no, this is not the right practice. These teachers don't know what they're doing, and I can't do this. It just means that I have doubt. I have questions. And then having questions, once we can recognize that, oh yeah, I'm feeling like I can't do this, then that's a different way to engage, rather than, I can't do this. I don't know about these teachings. Instead to say, I have questions. And then to work with, what are my questions? What is it that I'm unsure of? So some of you may have come here on Fridays for Dharma practice days. A number of years ago, Gil was teaching on the hindrances, a series. I think we met 10 times to talk about the hindrances. And one of the exercises he asked, and I attended, and one of the exercises he asked us to do was to, let's see here, to think of 10 questions that you have about Buddhism or meditation practice. Try to come up with questions which have a direct bearing on how and what you practice. Of these 10 questions, write down the one that is most significant for you personally, and then bring it to the next class. I was so excited, like, great, I'm finally going to get an answer to all these questions, right? And so I spent some time thinking about, what do I have, what are my questions, and then I wrote down the one that has the most significance for me personally. As an example, Gil said, are you unclear? Are you skeptical? Are you uncertain about the teachings? Are you ambivalent about the goals or the results of practice? Do you doubt your own ability to practice? And does this uncertainty affect how you practice? If it doesn't, then it's not a hindrance, right? But if it's having an effect that you don't want to practice, or that you feel a vacillation, you're not sure, should I do this, should I do that? Or maybe you feel hesitation that you don't even want to really engage. Then these types of perplexities or ambivalence or skepticism are hindrances. They don't have to be hindrances. You can have them and still engage with the practice. So I boiled down my questions to the one that I thought was the most important, and I brought it to the class. Gil provided an opportunity for us to ask, so I asked, put up my hand. Here's my question, was, do I have to become a monastic in order to be a serious practitioner? I really wanted an answer to this question. I had just wasn't clear on I felt so called by the Dharma, but does that mean that I needed to shave my head and wear odd clothing, live in, in a monastery? So I asked this question, and Gil's response, he nodded his head in acknowledgement, like, yes, that's a question. No answer. He didn't answer the question. The next person said their question. He said, that's a good question too. The next person asked their question. Yeah, that's a good question. It turned out to be really great, because then I started to explore for myself, well, what does it mean to be a serious practitioner? How can I find the answer to this question if it's not going to just get handed to me by my teacher? What does it mean to have simplicity What does it mean to renounce certain things? What does it mean to dedicate your life to the Dharma? What does it mean to the monastics? Like, they look different, right? They have shaved heads and wear robes. What would that mean to announce to the whole world, without a doubt, that, you know, the Dharma is the center of one's life? And what I discovered, right, is just by asking these questions, what does it mean for simplicity? What's the role of simplicity? Renunciation, a lot of meditation. I just started to find my way with it. You can see me now, right? I have hair and I'm not wearing robes, so clearly I didn't ordain. But I did dedicate my life to the Dharma in a way that made sense to me, in a way that I was available to me. I wasn't ready to ordain. So that's just having that question and then not having it answered really asked, kind of encouraged me and provided the framework for me to understand what was a burning question that I had and how to be with a question without an answer, but to kind of live my way into finding an answer. So in this way, whatever your questions may be, what things you have skepticism about, concern about, ambivalence about, whether it's the teachings, the teachers — today I'm the teacher sitting up here, but there's a lot, many of us — and about yourself, your own ability, you might ask yourself, what are your questions? What are the ones that you think that can help you find your way to? Gil, the instructions to us was, try to come up with questions which have a direct bearing on how and what you practice. Right, this tradition is about direct experience. It's not so much, as I said earlier, about philosophy and existential, metaphysical concerns. It's more about what can we know, what can we do here and now. So having a question can help alleviate doubt, which can get in the way of our practice. But also, having questions is a way of investigation. I keep on using this expression of kind of rolling up our sleeves. But kind of asking ourselves this question, what is this? Why am I doing this? Asking ourselves those kinds of questions, so we can, are like a light that can be brought into maybe some dark corners of our practice and our lives. Can be a different way to look at it, maybe, asking ourselves, what is this? Why am I doing this? Not only may it reveal some things, it may not also, but the act of asking can bring a different way of engaging, and therefore can also like bring up the energy too, can kind of make us more, I keep on using this word, engaged. I'll have to see if I can come up with a better one, but, you know, as opposed to like, oh, I don't know, and kind of, you know, being dismissive and feeling maybe sullen or something because we don't know or we have uncertainty or skepticism. Just by asking this question brings some energy and maybe some new viewpoints. So some of you may know that investigation is the second factor in the seven factors of awakening, which, as the name suggests, are seven qualities of mind that help support finding freedom, finding awakening. An investigation, this very thing, like, what is this? Why am I doing this? Is a quality that helps support awakening. But it's important to distinguish that this is not the same as psychotherapy. It's not the same as philosophical questions. It's more about, like, when we have a certain amount of stillness, a certain amount, we don't have to be the most still, then we can drop in this question, just allow it to arise in the mind. What is this? When we do that, it allows us to maybe to open up to maybe there will be an answer, maybe there won't be an answer. Maybe the answer will come in the form of a feeling in the body, a form of a memory, form of an image, a thought, or maybe there'll be no answer, right? All those things. But it helps us to become intimate and really engaged with what's happening here and now in the present moment. But if we do this when we're not have a certain amount of settledness, then it can easily turn into kind of just rumination. And just, this is what we do in our regular lives often, right? We just think about something over and over and over. I'm sure many of you have noticed that, right? Our minds have these habits to just think about things repeatedly. So investigation happens when there's some mindfulness and settledness. And we ask this question, what is this? Why am I doing this? With in an open-handed way, without clinging, without aversion, without an expectation that the results have to look a particular way or the answer has to be in a particular way. And in this way, we can investigate not only what is our experience, but what is our relationship to our experience. If we keep on asking, like, what is this? Sometimes we'll notice, oh, that we have aversion to the aversion to the knee pain. Or, why am I doing this? We can start to notice, like, oh, I have these, it's a mental habit to be planning over and over and over and over again. There's nothing wrong with planning. We need to do it. But just to recognize that, oh, this is a mental habit. And then lastly, this, as I've hinted at and pointed towards, this asking questions kind of change the ecology of the mind, if you will. We may be stuck in some aversion or something that's, I'll use aversion as example, something that's unwholesome, but unwholesome in the sense that it doesn't lead to freedom. But asking a question, investigating, is wholesome, can lead to freedom. So if our mind is filled up with things that don't lead to freedom, and we ask, what is this? We're introducing something that can lead to freedom. So then we're just shifting the whole ecology. Maybe not the whole, maybe just a little corner. But that's how it starts. And to kind of have a shift in the mind. So I talked a little bit in the beginning about how the Buddha encouraged questions. He and his monastic communities encouraged them to teach each other, to interrogate each other, to ask as a way to find some clarity and to be able to teach. And he kind of clarified that there's things to have questions about, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, path, practice. Maybe there's more, but in this example that he's saying it, these five topics. And then I talked about just the act of questioning is part of practice. So next week I'm going to talk a little bit more about questions, that there are types of questions. There are questions that the Buddha refused to answer. And there are questions that he said it's better not to ask these questions. He gave a particular list of them. So we'll continue on this theme of questioning as part of the path. But we have a few minutes, we have 3 minutes, I guess, 4 minutes, and wanted to see if, at this point, if you have some questions.
I have a question. If you feel like you don't really know enough to ask questions, and you approach things with a beginner's mind at all times or as much as possible. Maybe you could address the issue of trust, because that is what I tend to do. If I feel like I don't know enough in the presence of someone who knows much more than I do, I tend to trust their wisdom.
Yeah, so I have a few things to say here. One is that not having question doesn't have to be a problem, right? It's only a problem when it's a hindrance, when it gets in our way, that we have doubt and skepticism and we're not sure and it gets in the way. Questions are a way to help us engage. But if you describe this idea of beginner's mind, let me back up a little bit. Questions are a way to engage and to also help us not get into the, like, I know this kind of mind. I don't know what that is, that attitude, like, yeah, okay, whatever. You know, that dismissive. But if instead it's you're leaning in and curious, and there doesn't have to be a direct question. Maybe there's kind of a vague, oh, what is this? Oh, is that the way it is? And then you can, maybe it's an experiential type of question that you can find for in your own life and in your own practice. Is this true? Is your experience consistent with what you have learned? Yeah, so I think actually what you're saying is a great point, that it's, of course, having questions is a way for us to engage, but it's not the only way for us to engage. And some of us, we have faith, we have trust, we have confidence that the other person has our best interest or knows better has experience that we don't have, and we're willing to take that for how it is. But maybe I think what the Buddha is pointing to is not then holding on to the idea that this is the only way it is and never questioning it. Was that helpful? Thank you, Randy. So it's 11 o'clock. If you have questions, you're welcome to come up and ask me. Otherwise, I'll see you next week. Thank you.